VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome back to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today, Liverpool show their class in the Merseyside derby, but can Rafa Benitez ride the storm at Goodison? Bernardo Silva scores a goal of the season contender, Newcastle need points right now, and we get an in-depth look at how Ralf Rangnick will approach life at Manchester United. This is The Game. Hello and welcome back to the Game Podcast after what's been a very busy midweek of Premier League action with more to come. I'm Hugh Woozencroft alongside Jonathan Northcroft and Tom Clark as we look back and ahead to the weekend as well. We have to begin, gentlemen, with the Merseyside derby. Everton booed off after a 4-1 defeat in front of their own fans, many of whom left before full time. Liverpool had only won once in their last nine trips to Goodison coming into this. They scored four away against their local rivals, though, for the first time since November of 1982. They'd also scored at least twice in the last 18 in all competitions. They've hit 43 in the first 14 games of the season. They're purring, but despite that, they're actually third in the Premier League table, while Everton dropped to 14th. And as I predicted, Rafa's at the wheel was being sung by those away fans. Look, Liverpool were brilliant again, Johnny, but it did show stark difference between what's been happening over the past few years at both clubs.
Yeah, I mean, it showed a gap that is getting bigger and bigger and bigger, despite the fact that, I mean, Everton are one of the richest football clubs in the world, and they're not playing anything even remotely like that. They're barely playing like a Premier League team at the moment. And Liverpool are just, I think, probably playing as well as they did in the season they won the title. They're certainly scoring more goals. They scored 63 in all competitions this season already, which is kind of mind-boggling. And I mean, I read somewhere this morning that they had more XG in the first 10 minutes of that game than Everton had in four of their matches this season. It could have been 6-1, could have been 7-1, but for a great performance by Jordan Pickford. The harshest thing for Everton fans to try and stomach is how this gap has grown despite, you know, best part of £500 million spent on recruitment, despite having one of the richest owners in the Premier League. And in a way, in a phase when the money's been used up, because now the club's sort of struck by FFP and it can't really access that owner funding that Mashiri and his backer Usmanov might be able to provide, they've kind of spent the money. And what have they got to show for it? I mean, the best player on the pitch last night for Everton was Damari Gray, who Rafa Benitez managed to kind of cram in on almost a free transfer. So that's not the work of Mashiri or Marcel Brands. That's not the work that's been done at the club with this money. That's almost an accident that he's there. A lot of the anger is now turning on the board. It was turning on Bill Kenwright. It was turning on Denise Baxendale Barrett last night and on Marcel Brands. And it's understandable because, whether Rafa Benitez is palatable to Everton fans or not because of his Liverpool connections, it's almost a side issue. This club's had some of the best managers in Europe or some of the most sort of decorated managers in Europe now. Koeman, Ancelotti, Benitez, and it's getting worse. And that's why the fingers are pointing at the people at the top. Brands over recruitment and the board over how this kind of advantageous position has just been squandered so easily in the last few years.
Tom, I think that's a very good point. Is it time for the chairman, Bill Kenwright, the director of football, Marcel Brands, to answer for this? I know Steve Walsh was involved in recruiting a lot of those duds as well.
Yeah, Brands would be the one you'd be looking at, isn't it, in terms of the players that Johnny hasn't mentioned. You know, it reminds me a little bit of West Ham a few years ago and all the conversations we've had around them and a lack of identity and the praise that we're now putting on West Ham in terms of having that identity, David Moyes being in charge and buying David Moyes type players, et cetera, that we've said so much this season. And Everton just don't have that. They've been so confused about what their identity has been. Johnny listed the Koemans, the Ancelottis with aspirations for Champions League, huge amount of spending, and it's just not happened. So they're now in a position. They've got a manager like Rafa Benitez, who is perhaps of that David Moyes ilk, who could, in time, give them an identity. But it's going to take time, and it's going to probably take them selling some of their players. I mean, you know, and a lot of the analysis in recent weeks has come back to, oh, they really missed Dominic Calvert-Lewin. Put Dominic Calvert-Lewin in that team last night, and it would not have made a difference, I don't think, unfortunately. As talented a player as he is, he might have run the channels a bit harder. He might have caused Virgil van Dijk a few more problems, but they still would have been completely overrun in midfield. And I think the most telling thing is, yes, Liverpool were great. They scored some good goals, but I honestly thought Liverpool were in about second or third gear for most of the match.
I tend to agree with that. You know, I do think there was a much higher intensity, though. I think that showed. They get the job done, Liverpool, don't they? The players still treated it like a Merseyside derby. They still went at it. I think Everton's players did as well. I just think that the quality is so different. But I think I've now reverted to a very settled view on Everton, which is that the fans are going to have to accept that at least for the next few seasons, not much is going to happen at the club. And I think Rafa Benitez, for me, is the ideal manager for that, because he's done it at Newcastle before. No money to spend, you know, trying to wring the absolute best performance that you possibly can out of a squad that probably isn't at the level for what the fans want them to do. You know, if Everton finish 12th, I think you've got to be happy with that at this point in time. You know, they're just not that good, unfortunately. And when they lose, you know, Yerry Mina, I know the Everton fans as well think is a big miss and probably the spine of their team. I know Decore's been back for the last couple of games and Calvert-Lewin. But in reality, even if you add all three of those players, they aren't close to Liverpool. And I don't want to be harsh on Everton, because the top three clubs in the Premier League, I don't think anyone's really close to at this point in time. They are in a league of their own, and it's going to be very difficult for anyone to certainly outplay them, but even get a win against them. You know, you've got to really put in a fantastic performance at this point in time.
Identity's right. You know, Tom sort of hits the nail on the head there with recruitment, because it's not just about buying good players or you know, it's about buying players that fit together like a jigsaw pieces. And that's why Liverpool are so good. That's why Manchester City are so good. You know, Manchester City have been buying Pep Guardiola players for almost 10 years now. They were buying them before he arrived because they knew he was coming. Liverpool have been buying to order since Klopp arrived and probably before then. You can see how West Ham have got that strength because of their identity. You can see Arsenal starting to come together because they're starting to find players that fit. They've recruited players that fit the guys that they already have, the Sakas and the Smith Rowe's, and that's where you're right, Tom, that if it's going to be a turnaround for Everton, it's going to be a couple of years, or it's going to be at least a process of settling on who they're going to be, who are we as a football club, and then trying to fit the players around that. You can see the imprint of two or three different recruiters on that squad. You can see pieces that just don't fit together, and there's no sort of spirit to it either, because there's not a sort of settled culture, and it's just so far from the Everton that was there under David Moyes for so long. They've just drifted so far from that kind of, you know, dogs of war, people's club, hardest working, biggest underdogs in the league. They're just, I don't know what I'm looking at now when I'm looking at Everton.
One win in 11 for them, 6 defeats in their last 7 games. Can Rafa Benitez ride this out, Tom?
Yeah, I think he can, because I think partly because they've had so many managerial changes, partly because I don't know where they go after him, and I don't think they'll get relegated. So I think that's the position they're in this season. They probably, as you said, finished 12th. They need one of those seasons under a manager like Benitez, maybe clear out some of these players that just aren't good enough, move them on to leagues in Europe where maybe they'll prosper and maybe get some money in, and Benitez can sign some of his own players. It's not great. It's obviously not good for him. Obviously, his background as a Liverpool manager might count against him slightly, but I think any rational Everton fan would see where does the good come in sacking Rafa Benitez at this point, and I just don't see what the benefit is. So I think from that point of view, it's not perhaps not the way that most Everton fans would want their managers to stay in a job, but from that point of view, I don't see how he goes, because I don't see the sense in getting rid of him.
He is a manager capable of building clubs, building teams over a period of years. And if not him, yeah, who? Because also any new manager is going to want to put their imprint on it, and they're going to want the money to spend. And that doesn't seem to be there at the moment. So I would trust Rafa. There probably needs to be a clean out before the whole thing's put back together. That's where they should go. But it's such an angry football club at the moment that I'm not sure where they're heading. I'm not sure if the, you know, often when a board's under pressure like they now are, when they get barracked as they're leaving the seats in the stand, they react by trying to please the fans by getting rid of the manager. We've seen that at other clubs. So it might be they end up sacking Rafa to save their skins, but it wouldn't be the right thing to do.
And who would come in? That would be a massive question as well. Sean Dyche might finally get his opportunity at Goodison Park and all the pundits can stop wanging on about him. Salah scored two. He was irresistible again. And someone put to me last night, Liverpool have the best front three in world football easily. I probably agree with you. Yes, they do, but only if Salah's in it. Because I think if you take Salah out, well, let's put it this way. Liverpool's front three for me, with all due respect, there are some very good players there. Is Salah plus two. If my team is playing Liverpool and Salah's not in that front three, I will take it all day long. As good as Jota, Mane and Firmino are, he at the moment is probably the best player in the world. I mean, if you replaced him with Messi, I actually think Liverpool would drop a level. And that says something. It's true. It's true. He was brilliant, Tom.
There's the line the team will be using on social media later. RIP your mentions, Hugh. That's all I'm going to say. No, I think you'll probably be right. I think you're probably right. I think it's consistency with Salah, isn't it? You talk about Salah plus two. The other three, they all have peaks and troughs a little bit, don't they? Mane's been excellent. And there were times last season, I think, and maybe the season before where people were talking about him being as good as Salah. Firmino recently has had a little sprint of form just before he got injured. But with Salah, it's just the unbelievable consistency of his play that means, as you say, it is Salah plus two. Yeah, probably is the best player in the world, despite what Pep Guardiola says about Bernardo Silva.
When you've got a player like that who can run behind the defence the way he can, with the timing of those runs, the angle of the runs, and control the ball at speed the way he does, so can carry the ball beyond you and score, it's just enormously difficult to defend against that. I think in world football, maybe Haaland can do it to an extent. Mbappe can do it and Salah can do it. But Salah's probably better than those two, quite frankly, at the moment. And that's before you look at the other things he can do. I mean, he can dribble through you and score world-class individual goals. His pressing is unrecognisable to where it was 3 or 4 years ago. He's really embraced that side of the game. He's consistent, as Tom says, and he is the leader of that attack. And they're great players, but he does stand above them. And his appetite is something Jurgen Klopp talks about a lot as well. For him to be performing better now, arguably, than he was in that 2017-18 season, says so much about his mindset, and it's just a privilege watching him.
He's been absolutely sensational. I tend to agree with both of you. We've got to talk about some of the teams doing really well in the Premier League. Let's have a quick whiz through some of the other results in midweek. Chelsea weren't at their best. They did get all 3 points against Watford. Just a quick mention on this, as they're above Liverpool right now and Manchester City at the top of the Premier League. Tom, was that the result of champions not playing your best, still getting the job done?
I'm not going to go out on a limb and say it's the result of champions as much as I enjoy an early prediction, Hugh. But I think what's interesting about Chelsea in the last few weeks, I remember we talked earlier in the season and Alisson wrote a piece about in the Champions League about how they basically swapped 11s, essentially, backup 11 and the starting 11 was on the bench. And she said, oh, you could just interchange these two teams. What's been really interesting in the past few weeks is because of the injuries, it's not that kind of starting 11, backup 11. It's just a complete squad with a system and they can all interchange. You can get injuries. You know, they had Reece James out last night. You got players like Chalabar, Loftus-Cheek, players I didn't think would even get a look in under Tuchel, coming in, playing a part, Ziyech coming off the bench to get the winner. You know, it just looks like a really well-drilled, well-organised machine, if you like. And yes, there are certain more important players than others. Jorginho, Mason Mount was fantastic last night. But that's the most striking thing to me about Chelsea at the minute, is that it's this well-oiled, well-drilled, organised machine under Tuchel. And it doesn't really matter who plays. They seem to put in a kind of performance, at least. And he was interesting in the post-match afterwards, saying that they thought they were really poor. And I actually watched some of it and thought they looked brilliant. And I mean, the winning goal as well was a lovely, lovely team move. brilliant move down the left, and that pullback from Mason Mount for Ziyech. So that would be the thing that if I was Guardiola and Klopp, I would be most worried about.
Let's move on to Manchester City next. Steven Gerrard inflicted with a first defeat as Aston Villa boss after winning his first two games. There was a pretty resurgent second half from his side at Villa Park, managed to pull a goal back, but it's now four wins in a row for Manchester City coming in to this period of form, this run, Johnny, which we've seen take them to titles in the past. Do you think they're going to hunt down? I say hunt down Chelsea, they're only a point behind.
What was astonishing was watching Liverpool and experiencing how good they are and then thinking they're third and thinking, how do they feel given how well they're playing? And they can't shake off or even get ahead of Chelsea and Man City because of the consistency. And City, it's fascinating because I echo everything Tom says about Chelsea, but then City are the team with the greatest know-how in terms of how to navigate Premier League season and win it. And they've had some sublime performances this season. That last night wasn't one of them, but it was the other side of the coin. It was digging in a really awkward second half where you could see Villa with that kind of inspiration from Gerrard really having a go at them, playing really well, scored a great goal from Ollie Watkins and had City under pressure. They had to fight. You know, old Fernandinho was on, taking bodies in midfield and doing that bit of the game. And they're capable of doing that. Now, Ruben Dias scored a fantastic goal just to add to his kind of, you know, repertoire as a centre-half. I'm not the first to say it, but, you know, this top three is the best I've seen in the Premier League and we're not even halfway through the season. Almost impossible to guess who's gonna do it because they're just all such a level and it might come down to, you know, I'm already looking at Chelsea v Liverpool on January the 2nd and just thinking it's going to come down to the games between them.
And also, by the way, are we having Bernardo Silva goal of the season so far? For a team move, counter-attack, volley?
No. You can't leave two players back against Manchester City.
But the best bit about it is the start of the move and them coming out of defence. And I think it's Mahrez just on the edge of his own box who... I was watching it. I didn't know that this was the goal. I was watching the highlights and I thought, God, he's going to get tackled here. And it's the bravery to just hold off his man. And I think he nutmegs someone. That is just peak Manchester City.
But he could have been.
It wasn't a massive hipster to say that is as good as the volley, but it almost is. It's that was superb. And I mean, but the volley, I mean, come on. How many times do we see even the top level players shank that out for a throw in? That was pretty good. I can't think of a better goal in terms of embodying what a team is about and also the actual finish being wow.
As I brushed my teeth this morning, I thought definitely on the shortlist for goal of the season. So if it doesn't make the top 10, I will be stunned. But you know, there were other contenders last night. You know, we'll talk about them a little bit later on. But just the conversation that you were having a few moments ago, though, Johnny, about the top three in the Premier League being as good as ever. I was, once again, not to hammer him, listening to the Premier League chief executive Richard Masters talking about the redistribution of money and needing to give more to the EFL and saying, got to look at it from two sides. Yes, the EFL needs more money, but if we take away from the Premier League, that could harm this product of having amazing players. We haven't heard you on it, so what do you think?
I can see that argument. And one of the things that always really puzzled me about the Super League was the idea that the big, particularly those three clubs we've mentioned, but even just the big six in England, would start to try and give away some money to the European competition because there's a gap. There's a, you know, these three clubs that we're seeing now are so good because partly they're able to now collect pretty much the best players in Europe. They don't face the opposition that they used to. We've got a stricken Barca and Real. The Bayern Munich who probably can't quite match financially. And the gap's going to grow because of that, and they've also got the best coaches. So I get that the health of the Premier League is producing these brilliant teams, and they should be careful about trying to dilute it. I think it's a bit disingenuous of Masters to then say that means you can't, you know, spare a few coppers for the EFL. I mean, that linkage is a bit much. if they start giving more money like the transfer levy to the EFL, it's actually the smaller clubs in the Premier League that would be affected the most. I don't think it really would affect the big three or four or the big six. I think it would affect more the Southamptons and the Palaces and so on. That's probably what Masters is really talking about. we're saying, but look at Mo Salah. Do you want Mo Salah or do you want to, you know, help Rochdale?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's an extra, it might be an extra 10 to 15 million quid per team. Even the ones that get relegated are currently given 60 million just to go down to the championship. I think the money's there even for the teams lower in the league, Johnny. But, you know, I'm maybe a cynic. I'm going to get off Richard Masters' back. I'll move on to Leicester City's instead. More inconsistency from them. They drew 2-2 at Southampton. They were very wasteful in the end, in particular Jamie Vardy. Johnny, is this team now eighth going to struggle to finish in the top six for you?
Yes, it is. It's a transitional season. I think the attacking side of Leicester's game, probably, despite Vardy missing a few, he's had a great season, but it's probably still more or less there. But defensively, they've been a bit of a mess. Without the ball, they haven't been the old Leicester. And it's a squad that's been, you know, really hit by injuries, also affected by maybe a couple of key players, maybe a loss of form or decline. I don't know which one it is. If you look at people like Ricardo and Soyuncu, indeed he's not having a good season either. And then, you know, signing quite a lot of new players in the summer just makes it transitional. So I think Leicester fans are going to have to stick with it, actually, and accept the kind of season, frankly, they'd have been delighted by 8 or 9 years ago, which would be a mid-table season.
Tom, what do you think about where Leicester are right now? Can they turn things around?
I think they can turn things around. You know, looking at that table, we've talked about the top three and how close they are. I'd say kind of fourth, fifth, sixth is up for grabs for anyone down to Man United in 10th, I think. So from that point of view, yes, they're still in it. But I think in a more broader sense, and this is for any Leicester fans listening to come on Twitter and tell me I'm wrong, is it a terrible thing to have this kind of season? You know, watching them, yes, there's some inconsistencies. You've got players like James Maddison, who I'm going to mention because I put him in my fantasy football team at the start of the season and he did absolutely bugger all, only to now start scoring. He kind of embodies that kind of season they've got. It's going to be twists and turns, ups and downs, frustrating games like last night where they probably should have won. But they've also got young players coming through. They've got a manager who's probably going to be in demand in the summer if they can keep hold of him. They won the FA Cup last season. Is it a disaster if they finish ninth, eighth, and miss out on Europe, but bring some young players through?
Yes.
I mean, that's, but yes, it probably is in the case of modern football, but wouldn't it be nice if it wasn't? I mean, Leicester fans, tell me I'm wrong, or restore my faith in footballing sanity and tell me that it's okay. Yeah, we don't mind. Please let me know, because I think it'd be fine.
Yeah, I look, they've had some bad injuries in defence and that maybe has stopped them. But I've been slightly disappointed by some of their performances, particularly in Europe. I expected a little bit more.
Europe's been a weird one. I agree they've underwhelmed in that campaign. But the way to look at it is, if they could get to the end of the season and have Fofana back, James Justin back, Dewsbury Hall looks like he's a bit of a talent. You know, Maddison back in form, Patson Daka, who's a fantastic signing, Sumari settled into the league. That's not too bad. You know, mid-table, but a new team starting to emerge. I don't think that's too bad at all.
It's interesting you mentioned Patson Daka there. He was my shout for a striker that Brighton should have got their hands on. They weren't booed this week, Brighton and Hove Albion. Neil Mopay scoring a beautiful overhead kick. Now that is a goal of the season contender as well for a last minute equaliser at West Ham, which is a very good result for any team. But David Moyes' West Ham now haven't won any of their last three Premier League games, and they host the leaders Chelsea this coming Saturday. Tom, is this to be expected from West Ham, or do you think it's a poor run?
No, I think it's fine. I don't think you can say to be in fourth after 14 games doesn't really matter if they have a little dip in form. As I've said, they're currently top of that next bunch of teams after the top three. So they're in a great position. I think what will be most telling now is coming up to the January window, whether they go and get another forward of some kind. As great as Mikel Antonio is, I really rate him really highly. He seems to be improving all the time. Just having that difference, whether it's a young player, maybe from the Championship, who they think that in the style of Bowen and Benrahma that Moyes can bring on, or maybe a player from abroad who's going to add a bit of pace or direct running, a bit of skill and guile up front, or maybe just a fox in the box type striker. Just someone to add a point of difference so that in these games, when maybe they're looking to pinch a winner, they can throw someone off the bench, or maybe they can give Antonio a rest. That, to me, is where they're at now. They're in an incredibly strong position. Yes, they've had a little dip, but that would be the next thing. Go and get a striker and let Moyes pick him, because if anything is to show, it's the recruitment of late has been good.
I agree with that. I don't know how much you're going to disappoint the fans and all of those Mikel Antonio Stan accounts if he starts going on the bench. That's all I'm going to say. You know,
hey, look, you're going to disappoint me because he's been in my fantasy football team all season. So it'd be very disappointing. And it's one of the easiest picks, isn't it? But that's the point. Put him in your fantasy football team because you know he's going to play every week because they've not got another striker. So that to me, for where West Ham are at, they're doing really well in Europe as well. So that'd be great to have another forward in just to take the pressure off him as well. Because I think that does sometimes, you get that sense with West Ham that if they don't get the goal from the corner, which they did last night, and they will do for the rest of the season because they're so deadly, just having that player in the box who could maybe turn home, or he's going to take the one-on-one chance, because that's sometimes where I think Antonio is a little bit lacking in that kind of traditional striker sense, that deadly instinct sense. So that would be maybe where I'm looking at.
A lack of deadly instincts. Brighton, 10 games without a win now. Should their fans be pleased, Johnny, with their performance? Because I think they were very good. They played some lovely football. Jakob Moda, by the way, you have got to stick that one away. I'm sorry. That has to go in the back of the net. What a pass from Neil Mopay as well in behind Declan Rice. They've got Southampton away on Saturday. Is it must win for their fans, do you think, Jonathan?
Yeah, look, I give up really with what fans want, and the booing of Graham Potter was one of the most surreal sights or sounds of the season. I think any game's a must win for Brighton in the Premier League. That's not where they are. They're just performing way above actually where they should be. I mean, it's funny you mentioned Moda. He kind of epitomises them. They've got so many really nice players who maybe lack a bit of killer instinct and cutting edge. We know that's their problem. We know that they do need a little bit more of that, but they've got so much else. Yeah, they haven't won in 10 games, but they've drawn a lot of those matches. If they're to finish in the top half of the season, yeah, they probably need to start winning again and beat Southampton. But is that really what we should be judging Brighton on, or should we just be judging them on playing great football, evolving slowly under a really talented manager? And I suppose in that cliche, being a real asset to the Premier League.
Well, that's plenty of games covered in the Premier League this week and more to come. We'll be talking about Wolves, Burnley, Newcastle and Norwich next on the Game podcast. We'll also hear a little bit later on from Konstantin Ekner. He'll be discussing the new interim boss at Manchester United, Ralph Rangnick. Remember, if you're enjoying the podcast, rate us, leave us a review and make sure you're subscribed.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books. Contacts. Calendar. Double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Mother's Day is just around the corner, and it's time to pamper the special moms in your life. And what better way than with Osea's limited edition skincare sets featuring clean, vegan, cruelty-free products that are safe for your skin and the planet. Osea is a women-founded, women-led brand that's been making seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. This Mother's Day, Osea has two limited edition sets, perfect for gifting or keeping for yourself. Their Golden Glow body set includes three clinically proven bestsellers for silky, smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go Facial set has everything she needs to achieve spa-level results at home. They're so beautiful, you can skip the wrapping. For a limited time, you can save up to $48 on Osea sets, plus get free shipping. That's Mother's Day made easy. Pamper the moms in your life and get 10% off your first order site-wide with code MOM at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code MOM.
Wolves drew 0-0 with Burnley at Molineux. We don't usually reflect on goalless draws, but I think we've got to talk about Wolves. They've only scored one goal in their last four games from 40 shots, that is. They play some fantastic football and they're in the top six right now, but there has to be said that a lack of goal scoring ability could really cost them a special season. What do you think about it, Jonathan?
No, the best season in the last whatever was when Jimenez had that golden spell, and every team we've been talking about, Brighton, every team needs that final element. They might have a season like Brighton where they play lovely football, and I've been really impressed with Bruno Lage and what he's been able to implement there and his ideas. Jimenez is slowly coming back. I think he's got 3 goals this season. He's still a long way from where he was. Huang probably just had a initial bounce, and well done to anyone who got them in the fantasy team for that 3 weeks at the start of the season. And, you know, Adama's fallen off a cliff, and they've never replaced Jota. So there's problems up front, but they're really nice to watch, as you've been saying.
Yeah, it comes down to one man, doesn't it? Adama Traore. He's just nothing embodies that team better. He's so, so scary to watch, but so brilliant to watch, and yet so frustrating. You know, Danny Murphy on Match of the Day was talking about his decision making and highlighted a few points, but I don't think he went far enough. It really is poor. You know, it's more than just that moment when he could have played in Jimenez and he shot, and yes, he hit the bar. You know, there was another moment where he's attacking and he played the ball to Jimenez, which looked like the good decision, but he actually had Ayet Nouri flying up on his outside on the left. And it's the kind of move that you see top teams and top players, you know, Traore had driven into a central area, then flicked the ball, kind of a reverse pass into Ayet Nouri, who overlapping would have then sent the cross to the back post where Jimenez would have been sliding in. Chef's kiss, team goal, lovely stuff, 1-0, game over. Aren't Wolves brilliant? They're going to be in Europe. It's those kind of moments. And it's going to be a big season for Traore because he looks fantastic. I think Bruno Lage is doing some great things. If he can break through that mentality point and drum into him some of that decision-making in the same way that, say, Pep Guardiola did with Raheem Sterling, Traore could be a serious, serious player in the Premier League. But if we get to the end of the season, we're still talking about Traore making the wrong decisions on the counter-attack, then ultimately that'll be it. But that's what it comes down to. That'll be the decisive point in Wolves' season, I think.
Yeah, Bruno Lage doesn't get enough credit, actually. I think his team's played really well from the start of the season. Some very good football. You know, bear in mind, when he got announced, a lot of people were saying, who? I think he does deserve credit. And I wonder whether he will need some different players to make his dreams come true as Wolves manager, because I think the start has been good enough that you would say, with the right players, they could be a real, real success. But I wonder whether that will happen. But it'll be interesting to see how they do over the coming weeks. They're in a very good position, Wolves. As I say, a 0-0 draw with Burnley, who play Newcastle United next. A massive game at the bottom of the league this weekend. Earlier this week, a 10-man Newcastle held by Norwich City. Now, for a lot of people, a home game against Norwich is a banker. It was a relegation 6-pointer. A point each didn't really help either of them. It was Eddie Howe's first home game in charge in person. He was back in the dugout after that spell out with COVID-19. The stats men are now saying there's a 75% chance of Newcastle going down. No wins as yet this season, Jonathan. They've got to beat Burnley at the weekend. But what went wrong against Norwich?
They were lucky to get out of that game with a draw, actually. And I was tearing my non-existent hair out watching the Amazon coverage, because the narrative had been set up for this to be, oh, it's Eddie Howe's first game. Oh, look at the Gallagher end trying to suck the ball in. Aren't Newcastle brave? I mean, the reality is that they played with real spirit. I've got to say that. They played with a lot of spirit. So fair play, Howe definitely got them up for the game. But they didn't play with a lot of quality. They had a man sent off. They clung on. Norwich were very sleepy with all the possession for about an hour. Just didn't know what to do with all the ball that they had. And then Dean Smith made a good change, a couple of good changes, brought on Ida and Janulis and tore them apart. Amazing goal from Pukki, and Newcastle clung on. And yet the narrative afterwards was kind of, it's almost like the coverage has set it up for this to be the start of the revival. And even though it wasn't, they were still trying to kind of peddle that line. I didn't see it myself. They were better than they'd been against Arsenal, that's all I would say.
The thing about Johnny's point there about the narrative, my favourite word on the podcast, of course, is that as much as it's the media and the TV pundits, that will have been in Newcastle fans' heads as well, won't it? Let's be honest. That whole stadium would have been going, here we go, this is it, this is the start of the comeback. Of course we can beat Norwich. Norwich are rubbish. Of course we're going to win. And that's where, you know, something that myself and Gregor have talked about on previous podcasts, where with Newcastle, it's just this pressure thing now. They've still got another month. They've still got this whole Christmas period until they can sign anyone with all this money that they've got. It starts to ramp up, doesn't it? And then bad decisions get made, like Kieran Clark. It just starts to really feed into the team. And that would be my worry, that, you know, they're not necessarily massively worse than the other teams down at the bottom. It's just they've got that pressure like the others don't. You know, Norwich, but for example, don't have any pressure. We've talked about it recently. They've got a new manager. It's worrying for Newcastle. And also, Hugh, I know you'll probably say, there's loads of money. Don't worry about it. They'll sign anyone. But the kind of players, the kind of quality players they're going to want and needing to be signing, if they've not shown a little bit of an upturn in form come January, there might be some players who go, actually, mate, don't fancy this, even no matter how much money you throw at me.
The other one I've got on that is that Eddie Howe, brilliant coach, but not the best recruiter at Bournemouth.
They've got to beat Burnley this weekend, I think. 14 games without a win. The run that they are going to be under is absolutely horrific during this December as well. And I think that, for me, will play a massive part. I think, bear in mind, if you know, they're 3 points behind Burnley, who are also in the relegation zone. They are 6 points behind Watford. So if they lose to Burnley, they'll be 6 points behind both of those at least. And it doesn't really matter who else is in the bottom three. Newcastle will be firmly wedged at the bottom at that point in time. Who knows what Norwich City will get in their game. But if you look at Newcastle's run after the Burnley game up until January, when they can buy players, if they don't beat Burnley, they then go to Leicester, go to Liverpool, host Manchester City, host Manchester United, and go to Everton on the 30th of December. You can't really, at this point in time, predict many points out of those games after Burnley. That's why the Burnley game is so key. But I think if you go on a run of six defeats to end the year, and then you try and say to players in January, come and join us, we'll stay up if you join, we're going to have a great revolution, it's going to be very tough. I mean, for me, if you're going to be the richest club in world football, at least throw some money at it. You know, that 250 million quid, you might as well spend it in January. Get players in who are happy to play for you in the Championship, or more money than has ever been spent in the Championship before, but at least it'll get you up. I mean, that's what I would do if I was in charge of Newcastle. You know, they got 250 million quid. You might as well sit 200 million down on it. That's all I'm saying.
But that's where, again, that kind of pressure breeds. You know, I was actually squirming a little bit listening to you read that fixture list, Hugh, because you're right, that game against Burnley, who, by the way, I, even as a massive Sean Dyche fan, I'm starting to get a little bit worried about myself, because they're quite Sean Dyche-y enough. So we'll see. That'll be a massive game. But the more disastrous Newcastle seem, the more slightly mad their spending might be, is what I fear. Whereas actually they need some slightly sensible recruitment. Yes, they need to spend a lot of money, but they need to make some good, solid signings that are going to lift that squad up a few notches. They don't need to be going and spending millions and millions of pounds on untested players from Europe. And that's slightly what I fear might happen, as if they have a disastrous few weeks, that it'll just, all logic will fly out of the window. And yes, as you say, Hugh, throw some money at it, but do so in a completely illogical way.
This team, I mean, just drink this in, they haven't won since May. It's really difficult to not win a game since, in any competition. They haven't won a match since May, and we're looking at that fixture list. It could be, it could be January before they've got a chance of winning. The pressure, as you've been saying, is just gonna ramp up, and that Burnley game looks enormous because they do need to do something pretty quickly to relieve it. But hey ho. It's going to be fun. it's a fascinating experiment.
Should we end with a prediction, Hugh? Come on, we've talked it up now.
Nil nil.
Come on.
And it will feature first on the game podcast as well next week, by the way, I'm sure. No, look. My view on it is, in my mind, I just wish there was an all or nothing behind the scenes Newcastle till I die type documentary going on right now, because you know that meme that's one of those inflatable things outside of the car lots in America that's just got its arms flailing in the air? That's what I imagine everyone is like inside St. James's Park right now, because how you're meant to recruit top players, which is what we expect them, at least mid-table Premier League players, to come into the club. You know, when you are staring down the barrel of a near certain relegation, it's going to be very, very hard. You know, the strangest thing is there's going to be loads of negative stories about how much money Newcastle are going to have to spend on wages and players to get them out of it. But what other option do they have? What else can they do? They're going to have to massively overspend on people like Callum Chambers, no doubt, to try and get themselves out of it. So, you know, it's a difficult one.
The funny thing about those inflatable things you're talking about, Hugh, is that they're full of hot air. Get it?
Brilliant.
See what I
brilliant.
Did there? See what I did there?
I like what you did there. Yeah, I like what you can come back. You can come back.
Yes, thanks.
Up next, we're going to talk about Manchester United. The brilliant Konstantin Ekner joins us to tell all about Ralf Rangnick. So the caretaker manager, Michael Carrick, has now just one more game in charge. It comes against Arsenal tonight, if you're listening on Thursday, in the Premier League. Konstantin Ekner joins us on the Game Podcast. He's written a magnificent profile piece on Manchester United's new interim manager, Ralf Rangnick. How are you, Konstantin?
I'm fine. How are you guys?
Very well. Rangnick has finally been announced. As I say, he won't be in the Old Trafford dugout against Arsenal due to work permit issues. What should we expect when he arrives?
We should expect someone who has a clear vision of what he wants to do. I think like Rangnick, there might be some questions about his coaching style these days because he hasn't done much coaching in the past 10 or so years. But what he really does well and has done well in the past is be a strategist and have a vision and determine a certain style his team and the club should employ and play and embrace. And so I think that's what United fans should expect from him, that he really knows the direction where United should be heading.
A lot of people have remarked around why he has never had one of these huge jobs if he's such a brilliant coach. He has done a great job at building football clubs, but why do you think this is his first major managerial appointment and it's only for 6 months?
He's not the easiest character, I would say. He wants to really have a say in most of things. So in regards to, let's say, Bayern Munich or Borussia Dortmund, so the big clubs in Germany that might have been, you know, potential candidates for him to go. I don't know if a club like Bayern Munich wanted to give him the keys to the kingdom and want him to have a say in everything, because there are other powerful people, and there have been powerful people in Bayern Munich like Uli Hoeneß and Karl-Heinz Rummenigge, who just wanted to still be in charge. And with Rangnick, it's a bit different when you look back at his time at RB Leipzig, for instance. Sure, there were other people. There were the investors from Red Bull, and there were some, you know, people from Austria who had something to say in terms of what RB Leipzig and their sister clubs, Red Bull, Salzburg, and so on, what they wanted to do. But Ralf Rangnick was in charge. He determined player recruitment, and the youth academy was under his guidance. And of course, he was also coaching the team for a while. And if he wasn't coaching the first team of RB Leipzig, then he selected the person that coached the team. So he was really the be-all and all in terms of decision-making at RB Leipzig. And the same goes for his time at Hoffenheim, where he had a rich investor behind him in Dietmar Hopp as SAP. But still, Ralf Rangnick was the man. He was there in terms of decision-making. So I think many, many bigger clubs in Europe or Germany, in that regard, they don't want to have someone who's the be-all and all person. Now with United, the situation is quite specific and quite special because of what has been going on for quite a while, and the post Sir Alex Ferguson era. So I guess now they hand him the keys to the kingdom, at least for a while.
Johnny, what do you think about Ralf Rangnick's appointment? Do you think he will be a success here at Manchester United? And really, what is that? Because he's an interim with 2 years afterwards as a consultant. What do you think this appointment is designed to do?
Well, I think they have to commit to him. And it's fascinating listening to Konstantin on exactly how much he likes to force through and control the vision that's being implemented. There's no doubting the quality of that vision. There's no doubting the intelligence of that vision and the success of that vision. If you look at how Hoffenheim and then Leipzig progressed, thanks to Rangnick's kind of magic touch in terms of tactics, recruitment and culture, establishing that at the club. So United have got to commit to it. I think if they do, I think there's then two things to look at. There's the short-term phase where he's coaching, and it will be fascinating to see. You know, he last coached in 2018-19 and was pretty good, but, you know, football continues to evolve, so it'll be fascinating to see that. But then there's a two-year consultancy period, and if they allow that to become a proper involvement and not just a kind of ceremonial association to reward him for being interim, then I think absolutely this can be a fantastic move by United. I think Solskjaer helped restore something that had been lost under Mourinho and Van Gaal, which was a sense of culture, identity and soul. But, you know, as we've talked about before, probably they weren't so hot on the football side. There was a lack of that sort of real top-class football identity. And it can provide that, but they have to commit to it. It's not just down to him, it's down to the club as well, I think.
Manchester United were keen to stress Rangnick's experience in their statement announcing him as the interim manager. There was lots of it, and it felt very weird as a Manchester United fan to read it, because suddenly the club values experience and it's all important. You know, the appointments that were there before stressed that we almost valued inexperience and wanted the coaches of the future, maybe valued vibes a little bit more. Constantine, what do you think will happen to Darren Fletcher, who is in a director of football role, Michael Carrick, and maybe some of the, you know, other major names in the football side of things at Manchester United? Will Ralf Rangnick clear house?
I don't know if he has the power to do so, because they're still, like, Darren Fletcher still has a certain reputation and a certain standing within the club and with, you know, in regards to probably the owners. I don't know exactly what his standing is, but I still have the feeling that it would be a long way to go to get rid of him if you really want to get rid of him. I think for Darren Fletcher's own sake, he should take a little bit of a backseat for the next 6 months, and then maybe further, depending on what this consultancy role will eventually be, because we don't know really. I mean, consultancy is or consulting is kind of a term that can be everything and anything. But I think if you are Darren Fletcher, you should take a little bit of a backseat or even embrace it as kind of an internship, you know, learning from Ralf Rangnick and then maybe using some of the things you learned in the next 6-8 months from him and then employing some of the things or, you know, using that time to gather experience and make yourself better in a way. Because right now and in the past few years, there was a lot of learning on the job going on at United with Fletcher, Carrick, Solskjaer also. So right now with Rangnick, he might not have the, you know, a huge collection of trophies. And surely there are some negatives or some points of criticism you can still make in regards to Ralf Rangnick, otherwise he would be probably the best coach in the world. And he isn't. He is one of, but he's one of the best football visionaries. So that's something you should use and praise. And, you know, in regards to Darren Fletcher, for instance, probably really should, you know, consider the internship in a way.
Strikes me that Darren Fletcher and Michael Carrick are exactly the kind of people who can or should be learning from Rangnick. And I think it's a great opportunity for United in that sense. Fletcher's not been there that long in his, and it's a kind of slightly, you know, vague role that he, or vague title that he's got, but he could be the next director of football, the proper guy in charge of recruitment. And Rangnick's record, the Red Bull record in recruitment is probably the outstanding number. That's probably the number one sort of football organisation for recruitment in the last 10 years in world football. And Darren Fletcher's a bright guy. He's a humble guy. I think he's the kind of guy that will try and learn under Rangnick. And that's a great opportunity for United. And similarly, I think Carrick has got coaching abilities. We've seen it. It's too easy to say, oh, he was part of Solskjaer's regime. It's his fault. We don't know what the decision-making process was there. But we also know that Kieran McKenna was heavily involved and Solskjaer was manager. So to say it was Carrick's fault is a big leap by people. Let's judge him what he's done so far, which has been pretty sensible as an interim, and give him the chance. And he's a very studious, serious guy who will be really interested to try and learn from Rangnick. And don't forget, Fletcher was involved in Rangnick's recruitment. Fletcher wanted this. So I think that's a great opportunity for United. For Rangnick to leave in a couple of years and to have maybe a director of football in waiting and to have apprenticed Michael Carrick's coaching.
I think there might be a culture shock coming at Manchester United for a few people. In particular, Tom, the players. Who do you think is going to excel under Ralf Rangnick, given what you've heard about him? Who do you think will fail?
Well, it's really interesting. I watched yesterday a kind of hour-long interview with Rangnick talking about his coaching style, and it's been interesting to hear Constantine talk about this consultancy role, because I half wonder whether Rangnick would have pushed for a more sporting director official title and had to compromise on consultancy, because this is a guy obsessed with building something from the start. And from that point of view, you know, United aren't a blank canvas, but as Johnny says, that's what Solskjaer did. He's left this squad now, a pretty talented squad. The bad apples are gone, if you like. So it's perfect for Rangnick if he's given the keys. But as you say, in terms of a culture shock, I think the players are in for a bit of a surprise. I don't think it's going to be one of these where we see an immediate bounce, because by all accounts, and Constantine, I'd be interested in your views on this, the kind of football Rangnick likes is, to quote him in this interview that I was listening to, the heavy metal football. It's not a slow waltz. You know, he talked about his similarities with Klopp. He talked about things that they've done at Red Bull. He talked about the five different phases of play. How do we deal with the ball? How do we deal with the opposition having it? What do we do when we win it? And what do we do when we lose it? And all of it is geared towards pressing, pressing as a team. Talks about winning the ball back within 6 to 8 seconds after you lose it. And he talks about what to do with it in the 10 seconds after you get the ball back. That takes time, that takes training, it takes fitness. And it's the kind of football that we've not seen from Manchester United for a long, long time. And so I'd be interested, like, Constantine, has that always been a theme with his teams? Do you think that's something he's going to implement with this United team? Because I think if he does, to answer your question to you, players like Jadon Sancho, Mason Greenwood, Marcus Rashford, young players with pace who could really benefit from that kind of system. You know, imagine those front three flying at a defence, pinching the ball back and then going on the attack. That's going to be terrifying.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. I think people often look now at his RB Leipzig teams, although, I mean, look at it precisely, then he hasn't really coached, or he didn't really coach the team for long. He was more of a sporting director there at Leipzig for most of his time. So he was more involved in recruiting and also recruiting the coaches, by the way. So Ralf Hasenhüttl was one of his favorite appointments as RB Leipzig manager. And Ralf Hasenhüttl also embraces kind of that high intense pressing style, has done so in the past. But when we look at Ralf Rangnick's career, I think the most striking example of how his football should look, or he wants it to look like, is Hoffenheim. And there was a time when he played essentially with three center forwards and another number 10 behind it, and three fast-paced strikers, and just, you know, getting the ball somewhere in midfield with employing great tacklers in midfield, getting the ball and then using these, what you just said, these 8 to 10 seconds, and he believes in that, using the 8 to 10 seconds until you create a shot, because he believes if it takes longer than the 10, 12 seconds, then basically the opportunity to create a shot or to have a chance to score a goal is more or less gone, is you know, below 5% or so. So he believes really in that kind of also statistical evidence. And he believes that you need direct players who want to drive towards the goal. He wants pace, and he also wants strikers who get separation from defenders. And that's something, when you look at United, there are a couple of issues, or have been in recent times. Strikers don't necessarily get separation from defenders. They are somewhere stuck or even get lost within the opposing defense. And also the connection between, let's say, midfield and the attack is not there. So you have maybe a great tackler in, or you have intense players who can regain possession. But what then? There's no connection between the midfielders and the rest of the attack. And that's something Ralf Rangnick will work on. And also there might be some players who will suffer then, because they might not be up to par and they might not fulfill the tasks Rangnick wants him to do. So that would be interesting to see. And also in the past, if you look back at Ralf Rangnick's career, there have been a few, let's say, diva-like players who didn't want to do any defensive tasks, who didn't want to track back and so on, like Krasimir Balakov, the Bulgarian playmaker who played for Rangnick when Rangnick coached VfB Stuttgart. So Balakov was, you know, later parts of his career, and he was a typical, somewhat old-fashioned number 10. So he liked to get the ball somewhere behind the halfway line, play a nice pass, you know, create shots, but do it more in a slow fashion. And yeah, a little bit old-fashioned in a way, but he was, of course, a tremendous technical player, but he wasn't really one to put on miles there. And Rangnick was pretty much not in favor of Balakov, who was an institution at Stuttgart because of what he achieved with the team. So, I'm sure Rangnick knows that he has to be careful with just dropping stars and benching them and so on. But he also has a clear vision. So I don't think he will shy away from benching someone if a certain player doesn't really commit his all to what Rangnick wants to do, at least over a couple of weeks. Then he will make these hard decisions. And I hope for him that at United and the front office and all the other people in charge back him when it comes to these tough decisions.
Whisper Ronaldo quietly. Konstantin Ekner, thank you very much for joining us on the Game Podcast. You can read his brilliant profile piece on the Times app right now. But listen, make sure you're subscribed and you can get all of our award-winning journalism to the Times and the Sunday Times as well. If you sign up today, you'll get yourself 1 month free. This is the point. I say thank you to Tom Clark. Thank you to Jonathan Northcroft and Konstantin for being with me today, and to all of you for listening. As I say, make sure you're subscribed. It's thetimes.co.uk/thegame. Loads for us to talk about between here and Monday. We will see you then.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.